Arm and courage run in your family, from the paterfamilias to all his children. I am an admirer of your father already, as you know.
As am I, for he is both a soldier and a statesman.
A statesman, Hamilton said,
and I could not tell if he took me seriously or not.
You think there is glory enough in that?
I do, I replied. I wish now that I'd said more. I wish I'd said that he need not prove himself to me or to the world. I think I didn't say it because I was young and foolish and quite out of my depth when it came to the demons that haunted the man I loved. But I sometimes fear that I didn't say it because I didn't believe it, and that he knew. After the door closed that night, and I went up to bed, Angelica asked, "How desperately do you want him?" I'd not given voice to the depth of my feelings for Hamilton yet, not to anyone. But if anyone would understand, my sister would, and I wished most deeply for Angelica to approve. I think I fathom now what you said to me that night. She wound her fingers with mine. What night? When you eloped, I whispered. Love is a thing beyond reason. Oh, my sweet sister. Yes, it is.
She pulled me into a hug and peppered me with a million questions about all that had happened between us, finally concluding with,
"He's a hard-working man, Betsy. You know I'm fond of him. But he's also an ambitious one. Could you be satisfied with a man who is always striving for more?" I gave careful thought to her question, but I didn't consider ambition a fault. After what Hamilton and I had discussed earlier in the evening, I took some solace in his ambition, for I believed that in pursuing it, he'd find the glory he so seemed to want without having to share Phaethon's fate. And everything I knew of what Alexander Hamilton had overcome and achieved, I admired. So, whatever he accomplished next, I would be proud to stand at his side should he ever wish it. Perhaps I was a fool for thinking he would.
I'm not sure I could be happy with him, I admitted. But happiness seemed too flimsy a thing to reach for.
I might have found happiness with a less complicated man, a polite and dutiful man like Tench Tillman. Instead, I was drawn to Hamilton, who challenged me to be so much more than a fine-tempered girl. And the person he brought out in me? I wasn't sure I could be happy again without. Answer to the inquiry why I sighed. Before no mortal ever knew a love like mine so tender, true, completely wretched, you away, but half blessed e'en while you stay. If present love obstacles face, deny you to my fond embrace, no joy unmixed my bosom warms, but when my angel's in my arms. Sonnet by Alexander Hamilton for Elizabeth Schuyler.
Plink, plink, plink. The sound of pebbles hitting glass scarcely cut through my dreamless nighttime reverie as I read a sonnet Alexander wrote me. It was all, everything, happening so fast. And I couldn't quite believe it was happening to me. My sister shook me, holding a candle aloft.
Betsy, your suitor is at the window.
But it's the middle of the night, I whispered, and though I ought to have been delighted to see him again, my breath caught with worry, remembering the expression on Alexander's face just before he'd left my uncle's house that evening, some dark cloud before his eyes. Surely it was nothing, for I had proof of his love in my hands.
Kitty groaned and covered her face with a pillow.
Oh, fasten a robe and go down to that prowling tomcat, or he'll never go away, I said. But Aunt Gertrude will hear.
For pity's sake, you're hopeless, Angelica said. Have I let her discover you holding hands and kissing before? The baby and I will go down with you. If Aunt Gertrude hears us, I'll tell her the little one was fussing.
It sounded unforgivably duplicitous, but it was precisely the sort of mischief at which Angelica excelled.
And because I could still feel the brush of Hamilton's hands upon my skin, and because my lips were still sweet with his kisses, I was powerless to resist either of them. In slippered feet, Angelica and I both stole down the stairs. Quietly, I unlatched the back door to find Hamilton there, his eyes bright as he slipped inside the house.
"Ladies,
the keeping room,"
Angelica whispered, nudging us to where the silver and valuables were kept and servants were not permitted. Then, with my baby niece in her arms, Angelica posted herself as guard, closing us in alone in the darkness with but a single candle.
"Is something the matter?"
I whispered to Hamilton in the dim light.
"Yes,"
he said quite gravely, a tremor in his voice.
"I have something to say, and if it waits another moment, I shall lose my nerve."
I'd never seen him afraid before. Angry, dutiful, officious, charming, reckless, smug, cynical, all those things. But never afraid until now.
"The story I told you before, the one about my parents, there is another version."
"Another version? How could there be more than one?" He took my hands in his, gently stroking his thumbs over my knuckles, then bringing them to his mouth to kiss.
"There is a version of the story I have entrusted to no one else but my dear friend, Lawrence. But I cannot bear to deceive you."
I should have given that casual admission more thought. That there was someone Hamilton trusted, someone he had trusted more than me, a man I'd never met, a man of whom he spoke worshipfully. And Hamilton was not a man to worship. But all I knew then was that he was speaking of deception, that he was making me afraid now, too, and I'd always believed bad news should be delivered quickly.
"Please tell me."
"I let you believe my illegitimacy was a mere wrinkle in the law. What I didn't say was that my mother was jailed for multiple adulteries, suspected of worse, held captive in a dank, dark cell, half-starved for months. And when she died, she was denied even the right to pass on property to her whore children."
I will never forget the way in which he uttered the word, "whore children," as if hissing from a brand pressed to his skin, and it made me grasp his hands tighter, tears in my eyes.
"Oh, Alexander,"
he swallowed.
"I don't even know if the man who I called my father is my father."
I swallowed too, meeting his eyes so that he would know that I meant what I said.
"I understand, and I hold you blameless. None of it is your doing."
Manfully, he squared his shoulders.
"That is kind of you to say. But in courting you, I've shot quite above my station. I can only plead love in defense of myself."
Emotion lodged a knot in my throat. He loved me. His sonnet had confessed as much, but to hear it from his mouth, to see it in his eyes.
He continued, "My feelings for you make me restless and discontent with everything that used to please me, and I began to imagine the world might be different. But I am a man of hard realities. If this must end things between us, I will harbor no ill will."
So this was why he'd looked so tortured before he left earlier tonight. He thought it might be our last night together. And now his hands actually trembled in mine. I reached for his cheek and touched it tenderly.
"Alexander, this makes no difference to me."
"It has made all the difference to my life. It is bad enough people think I am..."
"I don't care what anyone else thinks, because I love you. I love your mind, the variety of your knowledge, your playful wit, and the excellence of your heart. I love you for reasons that defy any explanation at all."
Angelica had been right. Love was a thing beyond reason, beyond control, a thing almost predestined. And now that this powerful emotion had finally taken hold of me, I was entirely helpless against it. He must have felt it too, because his mouth closed over mine with such hunger it nearly frightened me. Or maybe the hunger that frightened me was my own.
I realized my compromised state, only my nightclothes between us. But as his hands slid down my back with carnal intimacy, and his mouth went to my face, my neck, and my hair, there was no liberty I would not have allowed him.
Betsy, he said hoarsely, stroking my hair, you deserve better. With me, your future rank in life would be a perfect lottery. You might move an exalted company or a very humble sphere.
I don't care. All I heard was that he was speaking about a life with me, a future with me. I love you.
I said it like an incantation. Could you truly be an Aquileia and cheerfully plant turnips with me?
Yes, I whispered, smiling as I clutched at him.
Even if America were lost.
I knew how desperate the circumstances were, but could not bear to think of the war being lost. Not after all the suffering and sacrifice.
That was the only reason I hesitated to answer.
Alexander swallowed.
I was once determined to let my existence and American liberty end together. But you give me a reason to outlive my pride. If the war is lost, could you live as the wife of a fugitive, leaving behind your home and everything you know?
I'm already the proud daughter of a rebel, sir.
He smiled at that. What think you of Geneva as a retreat? I am told it is a charming place, favorable to human rights. Would you go with me?
This time I didn't hesitate, not even long enough to think. I would go anywhere with you.
He pressed his forehead to mine. Then, Elizabeth Schuyler, will you consent to have me for a husband?
Yes. Yes to anything. Yes to everything. Perhaps my parents wouldn't approve, but I wouldn't let them stop me. I felt certain that I could never be happy again without this man. I wasn't even sure I was myself, or who I'd been before. Every plan, every desire, every hope was lost to all-consuming passion. I want to be yours this very night.
Temptress.
Hamilton groaned and pressed against me, giving me evidence of his desire. And I desired him, too. So much so that the only thing that seemed right was for us to come together skin to skin.
But at length, he held me away and took a steadying gulp of air before we lost our heads completely. It must all be done right between us. I must write for your father's blessing.
He might not give it, I admitted. But Hamilton replied,
I am told I am very persuasive with a pen, especially when I want something. And I want you.
My breath caught to hear it. I knew he was persuasive with a pen. His beautiful sonnet was proof of that. But with my blood afire, I wanted it all to be done now. It will take too long to wait for permission. Papa will forgive us. After all, he'd forgiven Angelica. Go wake the Reverend.
Hamilton groaned again, this time with more pain. Betsy, I can't. I can't. What would people say if I were to run off with the daughter of General Schuyler? They would say I'm a self-seeking, fortune-hunting seducer, angling for advantage.
I realized that I would have loved Alexander Hamilton even if he were all those things. Even if he loved me only for the advantage I could bring him. Let them say it.
You know what I am.
A whore child, he meant. As if it was a crack in his soul that threatened to break my heart, too.
I cannot risk even a spot upon the reputation of any child we might have.
A self-seeking seducer angling for advantage would not pass up an opportunity to elope with the daughter of Philip Schuyler. Nor would he worry for the reputation of his child.
Only a man of honor would do that.
He might not be descended of a Scottish nobleman, I thought. But he had something more important than a noble title. Like my father, he had nobility of character. And though I knew it was madness that two people should come to love one another so passionately in such a short space of time, I wanted nothing more than to be his wife, even if it meant I had to wait.
Chapter 9.
December 1st, 1780, Albany. Am I making a mistake? I had been so certain of Alexander Hamilton, ready to run away and elope with him if he had allowed it. But now Benedict Arnold was a traitor, and I wondered how anyone could be certain of anything or anyone. Benedict Arnold, the hero of Saratoga, the man who'd lost much of the use of his leg in service to this country, a man I'd admired, a man who'd eaten at our table and flirted with my sister, a man who'd used Papa's long friendship to secure a posting at West Point, all while scheming to turn it over to the British, apparently believing my father would go along with his treachery. Never. But just as Papa's reputation had recovered, his friendship with Arnold now tainted him again. At the very least, it put his judgment into question. The betrayal was a blow both personal and symbolic, and Arnold's attempt to sacrifice West Point and the men inside it was a treason of the darkest dye. Despite Lafayette having suspected a traitor long ago, Arnold's treason was discovered only by some miracle of coincidence, in the nick of time, and Alexander had been there. Arnold immediately fled to the enemy. I went in pursuit of him, but it was much too late, my betrothed wrote from the field. Arnold had gotten away, but they'd captured his British spy master instead. John André. The injustice of it. That good, honorable officer, even if he was an enemy, would now hang for Arnold's crime, and his death would be brought about in some part by the man I was to marry. Alexander was bitterly sorry for it, so much so that when I pleaded with him to use his influence to allow André to be shot like a gentleman, not hanged as a spy, he did as I asked, though Washington would not hear of it. It isn't just, I'd fumed to my father. But Papa blamed Benedict Arnold. Very little is just in war, my child. In his letters, Hamilton blamed Arnold too, expressing sympathy only for the wife he'd abandoned. Her horror at the traitor is lost in her love of the man, but a virtuous mind cannot long esteem a base one, and time will make her despise him, if it cannot make her hate. My angelic Betsy, I would not for the world do anything that would hazard your esteem. 'Tis to me a jewel of inestimable price, and I think you may rely I shall never make you blush. I believed him, though I shouldn't have, because in time he did make me blush. Worse than that, he made me despair of the traitor in him, too. For though Alexander Hamilton did not betray his country, he did betray me. And now I struggle with whether love or hate burns more intensely inside me. But then, as a young woman contemplating marriage, the Arnold situation was a stark reminder that to marry a man was to share his fate and be vulnerable to all his decisions and mistakes. The traitor's wife and child would forever bear the brand of his treason. And I wondered, did Mrs. Arnold have an inkling of the darkness that dwelt within her husband? Or was she now bewildered at the stranger she had married? Still, Arnold's treason wasn't the only thing to fill me with doubts. When I agreed to marry Hamilton, I'd worried that my father would not give his consent for our marriage, especially when Alexander insisted upon confessing his sordid origins to Papa. My parents, both of proud lineages, had objected to my brother-in-law Jack Carter because they knew nothing of his family. And yet, my father told Alexander, "Your eloquence and George Washington's recommendation make me glad to welcome you to our family." That, and perhaps Papa's sense that if he did not give his permission, I would elope too. I suspected as much because Papa also told Alexander, "It gave Betsy's mother great pain to miss her daughter's wedding, and me as well. I should not like to suffer it a second time." "We'll see you married properly, Betsy," Mama said under her breath, before she embraced Hamilton when my family came to Morristown. "Don't you dare follow in your sister's footsteps." But we'd long since left that winter camp, and 6 months had now passed in waiting,
because Alexander feared to neglect his duties in such a perilous time, and he'd therefore refused to take a leave of absence for our nuptials. He'd even considered delaying in order to pay a visit to his friend John Lawrence, who, having been captured and paroled by the enemy, was not permitted to leave Philadelphia until a prisoner exchange could be arranged. Worse, the many beautiful love letters Hamilton sent while we were apart were so filled with misgivings that they'd begun to stir my own. Though he wrote that I was his charmer, his angel, and his little nut-brown maid, he also wondered whether our feelings would change while we were separated. He wrote of his friendship and his love, his affection and his desire, but also kept an accounting of who wrote more letters, fearing his greater frequency was a sign of my lesser affections. I wrote. Of course I did. It was only that I couldn't keep up with the pace of his correspondence. He still asked again and again if I wanted him, and entreated me not to deceive myself if I couldn't truly be happy as the wife of a man without means. He even teased gently about a dream he'd had, in which he arrived to Albany to find me asleep in the grass, holding the hand of another man who had a prior claim. If I'd asked the name of this man with a supposed prior claim, he'd have dismissed the matter artfully, or teased that he meant Tench Tillman. But I knew better. It was Andre he meant. He feared that I blamed him for the death of a man I'd known first. A man Hamilton himself admired. A man I grieved for, in truth. But fearing it might come between us, I answered playfully, "Sir, your dreams malign me. For there is not now, nor ever has been, a man with prior claim." Even so, his letters leaped from flattery to taunts, from arrogance to insecurity, from love to despair. And in doing so, they pushed doubts into my mind, such that I had to force my attention to the embroidery in my hands. "You'll never finish in time for the wedding if you just stare at your needle," Peggy said from where she sprawled upon our shared bed. I'd been working for days on a wedding gift. Once completed, the matting would form a decorative frame for a miniature portrait of my betrothed. And as I waited Alexander's arrival, I carefully worked the needle through linen held taut by a wooden hoop. Satin stitches, stem stitches, French knots. Each one making me think about the fact that our lives were soon to be tied together too. If indeed he would finally come for our wedding. Almost against my will, I remembered Kitty's words. "I doubt I'm the only lady to whom he has pleaded but the war." I'd scarcely shaken the thought away when, at last, the clatter of hooves upon ice-covered oyster shells reached our ears. I bolted to my feet. I wasn't the only one. "Is he here?" one of my brothers called from across the hall. The house erupted in near pandemonium. My family liked Hamilton. In the course of our courtship, he'd managed to win over each and every one of them. He talked finances with my father, philosophy with Angelica, Dutch traditions with Mama, war stories with my brothers, and beaux with Peggy, advising her how best to catch and keep one. And now my siblings and I raced down the stairs to greet him. Even his prince scowled in disapproval at our lack of dignity as he opened the door. I ought to have waited for Mama, who was pregnant again, to heave herself up from where she lay abed to come down and greet our guests. But I was far too eager. In fact, I quite nearly raced past Prince out into the blustery cold and swirling snowflakes in the open doorway, where stood two men wearing ice-crusted cloaks over blue and buff. But only one figure gladdened my heart to bursting. Alexander. The smile he gave me before presenting himself with a great formal bow all but erased the trepidation I'd felt moments before. "Miss Schuyler," he said, his satiny voice bringing back memories and making my pulse fly. I wanted to throw my arms around the neck of my betrothed and shower him with kisses. Instead, I beamed. "Alexander."
My eyes lingered on him as long as I dared, before politeness forced me to slide my gaze to his companion, who I recognized at once from Morristown. Mac! At my exuberant familiarity, James McHenry grinned and doffed his cap, just as my father reached the entry hall.
"Ah, Colonel Hamilton,"
Papa said, coming in from the back door where he'd been making preparations in the courtyard.
"You've joined us at last." "General Schuyler," Alexander said, almost standing to attention.
Papa hung up his snow-covered coat and the large feathered hat he favored, then made his way across to us.
"Welcome back to the pastures,"
he said, holding out his hand. Alexander shook it.
"Thank you, sir. General Washington sends his regards and regrets that he can't join the celebration."
Papa's smile broadened at being mentioned by the Commander-in-Chief.
"I think you must remember my friend and colleague on General Washington's staff, James McHenry. He's my guest for the wedding."
The only one. Tench Tillman had sweetly and sincerely sent his best wishes and a small gift, but General Washington couldn't spare him or any other aides-de-camp with Alexander and McHenry gone. And as for Alexander's family, well, how I loved my father for having made no issue of Alexander's illegitimacy. And now Papa simply behaved as if all were quite normal.
"Ah, McHenry, but of course. Come in, dry off, get warm. We're pleased to offer every comfort during your stay."
Thereafter, Prince collected hats and cloaks, departing our merry circle, but not before instructing other servants to relieve our guests of their satchels. And having finally made her way down the stairs, Mama held her lower back and said she would see to supper. Conversation turned to weather, war, and wine as McHenry followed Papa into his study. But Alexander quickly crossed back to me, his fierce blue eyes seeing right into the heart of me.
"Betsy," he said softly, intimately, "I want you to know that all these months, the only thing that alleviated the pain of your absence was looking forward to the moment we shall finally become each other's forever."
Unable to express the welling feelings inside me with the eloquence with which he always wrote and spoke, I managed only, "And you were always in my thoughts." He smiled as though I'd versified a sonnet, encouraging me to go on. "But I prefer you at my side."
"Well, then at your side I shall endeavor to stay. After all,"
his eyes twinkled,
"as you will soon learn, whatever affords you pleasure will always be most agreeable to me."
My face warmed despite the chill in the hall, but fortunately Papa's booming voice called my intended groom to join him, and Alexander promised,
"I shall see you later, my lovely girl."
The night before our wedding, the ball at our house was attended by all the best of Dutch Albany society. The Van Rensselaers and the Van Burens, the Ten Broeks and Ten Eycks, the Van Shakes and the Dows, and so many others. Neither snow nor ice nor howling wind seemed to deter our new Netherlander friends and neighbors from coming out to the pastures for the celebrations. Amidst boughs of holly and the light of countless candles, the salon on our second floor hosted festivities that included food and drink, dancing and music, and games and toasts. We danced minuets, cotillions, and Scottish reels until my feet ached and my heart soared. Alexander never seemed to tire, and I determined to keep up with him through every bar and set. I danced with Mac and my brother-in-law, Mr. Carter, a man 8 years Angelica's senior, whose business supplying the army for once permitted him time to join in the festivities. But Alexander could never wait long before declaring himself impatient and claiming me again. My fiancé appeared more at ease than I'd ever seen him before, and perhaps that wasn't a surprise, as these days of rest and merriment were the first break from military service he'd had in 5 years. Indeed, his eyes sparkled as he asked,
"May I steal you away for a moment?"
"By all means." I'd been hoping for a quiet opportunity to give him my gift. He took my hand and led me around the edge of the dance floor as we were stopped again and again by well-wishers, until we finally escaped down the stairs and into the cooler air of the dimly lit sitting room, which afforded us a modicum of peace and privacy. There, Alexander asked me to wait. And while he ducked away, I seized the moment to pull my gift from its hiding place in the cabinet next to the fireplace. Alexander returned before I'd barely completed the task, and held a large sack of his own. "Whatever is that?" I asked. He grinned and nodded at what I held in my own hands. I could ask the same. I smiled. "A wedding gift for my husband." He feigned a frown and stepped closer. "Your husband, madam? Do I know him?" Playing his game, I said, "Oh, you know him very well, sir. And your gift is for?" He came closer yet.
"For my wife-to-be. And before you ask, indeed you know her well. She has a good nature, a charming vivacity, and is most unmercifully handsome."
He arched a brow and closed the remaining space between us.
"And so perverse that she has none of those affectations which are the prerogatives of beauty."
How did he always manage to set my world a-tumble with his words? "Oh, you must be a lucky man, indeed. I hope you've shown her your appreciation."
He barked a laugh. "You saucy charmer."
I sat in the chair closest to the fire, so that I could see by the greater light there, and Alexander pulled up a chair of his own so that our knees touched. With a nervous smile, he placed the heavy sack onto my lap. I untied its string and worked the coarse cloth over the solid object inside. Impatience rolled off him so forcefully that I had to tease him further by taking great pains to slide the sack evenly off, a little on this side and then a little on that.
"And to think someone once told me you were the finest-tempered girl in the world," he said with a chuckle.
I yanked the sack away then as we both laughed. Removing the wrapping revealed a fine, carved mahogany sewing box. "Oh, it's exquisite," I said. I carefully lifted the lid, only to find another treasure tucked inside. A small, round, pearl-encrusted pendant. The pendant alone would have enamored me, but combined with the inscription and personal token inside, I knew not what to say.
"General Washington mentioned that Kitty Livingston had asked for a token of his esteem," Alexander explained. "I guessed you might like one from His Excellency, too."
"You guessed right," I said, in awe as I stared at the circle of General Washington's dark blonde hair under a glass covering inscribed with his name. How had Alexander afforded such finery? I couldn't imagine, but I could barely think on it through my embarrassment that Washington may have thought me a frivolous girl to want a clipping of his locks. Still, I wasn't so embarrassed that I didn't wish to wear it straight away. Fastening the chain, I said, "I'll cherish it forever." I looked up to find Hamilton beaming, and I added, "But I should not like you to think that I am the sort of woman who expects expensive—"
"You are the kind of woman who deserves this and every last penny I have squirreled away," he interrupted. "Besides, I am not entirely impoverished, my angel, and I am fortunate in my friends. John Lawrence regrets very much that he cannot be with us on our wedding day, and insisted upon advancing me a tidy sum to purchase this for you."
"I shall have to thank him when we finally meet," I said, of his mysterious and much-admired friend. "His generosity of spirit shall stand present for him as if he were a guest, and I shall wear this pendant near my heart on our wedding day."
"Good."
My beloved's voice turned stern.
"But don't think it will not irritate me a little to have another man's name so near your heart, even Washington's."
I laughed. "Near to my heart, but not inside it. For there is room there for no man but you. Oh, and the box is a most perfect gift, too."
Oh, and the box, she says, Alexander grumbled playfully. My turn, then.
When I nodded, he tore at the ribbon, and then unfolded the plain ticking I'd used to cushion the framed matting and portrait.
Oh, my angelic girl, what have you done?
I had your portrait rendered by Mr. Peel in Philadelphia, and then I designed and sewed a frame for it, I said, suddenly nervous. I wanted you to see how much I've thought of you all these months.
What fine, detailed work.
He paused in his admiration of my embroidery.
Only you must think me vain to keep a portrait of myself.
Well, I hoped you would leave it with me if ever you should have to go away again, I said, feeling a little foolish that I'd made him a gift I wanted myself. But he intertwined our fingers and leaned to kiss me.
I love you more every hour.
I very much wanted that kiss, but unfortunately we were interrupted. There you are, Peggy said, leaning into the room. Alexander cleared his throat.
Why, hello, little sister.
Sorry to intrude on your private celebration, she said, though Peggy was never sorry for such things. Mama beckoned me to find you to say goodnight. Guests are leaving.
Before long, everyone was gone, and I had the great pleasure, for one last night, of sharing a room with both Angelica and Peggy for old time's sake.
Years had passed since the three of us had stayed together, and just like we used to, we talked and laughed and teased until long after we should have gone to sleep. I can hardly believe that tomorrow I'll be wed, I whispered into the darkness, for the candle had burned down some time before. And bed, Angelica said. Angelica, I cried, my stomach tingling. But she only laughed. What's the use in having a more experienced older sister if she can't divulge the secrets of marriage? Do tell, Peggy said. I pulled the covers over my face, which of course they tugged back down. I'll say this, Angelica began in her world-wise way. A man enjoys a woman to be an active participant and desires her pleasure. So don't be shy, Betsy. What you don't know, Hamilton will teach you. My face burned, but I couldn't deny my interest in her advice or the way my body warmed at the idea of what Alexander might teach me. I shall take that under advisement, I said, with as much dignity as I could. Now please be quiet before I die. My sisters burst into giggles at my expense, but I was too happy to care. December 14th, 1780, Albany.
Betsy?
Papa called from the hallway.
It's time.
With teary eyes, Angelica took my hands. You are a vision. I doubt that, I said, a little discomforted by the attention. I wished to be a vision, but I would content myself to be unmercifully handsome in my bridegroom's eyes. Oh, but Angelica's right about something for a change, Peggy said, her hands clasped to her breast. Smoothing the fine sky-blue silk of my new gown, my fingers running over the embroidered flowers and tiny hand-stitched beads and pearls, I took a breath and reached for both of my sister's hands. I don't know what I'd do without you. Well, silly, you shall never have to find out, Peggy said, sniffing, and I caught her swiping at the corner of her eye when she turned away. Papa knocked again, just as the tall case clock in the hallway struck noon. My heart thundered in time with the deep chimes, and it felt as if my knees might go soft. But somehow I made it to the door to find Papa dressed in his best dark gray velvet suit, the one with the high collar, silver piping, and matching waistcoat.
My lovely child,
he said as Angelica and Peggy gave me one last hug and kiss each before they rushed downstairs.
Why, it's like looking at your mother on our wedding day all over again.
Oh, Papa, I said, the emotion in his voice making my eyes sting.
and he sighed, as if he were looking at me for the last time.
My little Betsy. Though I suppose, as a married woman, we shall now have to call you Elizabeth or Eliza.
It was the custom to give up childhood nicknames upon marriage, but I didn't wish for Papa to ever look at me differently than he did now. Betsy will do. I'm accustomed to it. My father gave a rare grin and held out his elbow.
Well, then, I do believe there's a very eager young officer waiting to marry his bride just downstairs. It wouldn't do to keep him waiting.
I took his arm, and down we went. Just outside the doorway to the formal blue and gold parlor, the members of our procession stood assembled. The minister, Mama, my sisters with the hen-painted silk fans I'd given them for the occasion, and Alexander. My fiancé cut a fine, dashing figure in his dress uniform. His smile beckoned me to come to him until Papa was relinquishing my hand. When the harpsichord began to play, the minister led us up the aisle of chairs filled with family and friends, the whole assembly brightly lit from the winter sunlight pouring in through the windows. The service was conducted in Dutch and English, out of respect to the groom. But I barely recalled a word because I'd never seen such unbridled joy shine from Alexander's countenance.
With love, yes. I believed that. But there was something else, too. In wedding, my family became his, too, and I sensed that gave him a sense of belonging. I promised myself that I would always ensure that for him. My parents would be his parents, my sisters would be his sisters, and my brothers would be his brothers. He'd never be without family again. I wanted to be alone with him to tell him so, but after the ceremony there commenced an open house of visitors who nibbled on honey cakes, marzipan, candied almonds, and my mother's famous ollekoeken, sweet dough fried in hot lard until golden brown. Then a sumptuous wedding feast of roast duck with dumplings, pork with cabbage, and baked apples and raisins. For dessert, imported chocolates, cinnamon bark, and spiced cookies, or cookies in English. Alexander and I never had time for more than an affectionate smile or a stolen kiss. Until, suddenly, we were alone in my childhood room, now turned into a bridal chamber, lit only by a warming fire. Music and laughter reached us from below stairs, but it felt as if it came from 1,000 miles away when Alexander looked at me with desire.
"You're finally mine,"
he said, his voice tender but full of a gravity that hadn't been there before. His hand clasped mine, and his thumb rubbed over my wedding band, a ring made of 2 linked circles of gold that swiveled to join as one. Alexander had engraved them with our names.
"And I am yours, too."
He spoke as if he were trying out the premise, drafting an argument and seeing if he could make it work. I was determined that he would.
"Show me."
He unwrapped me as he had my gift the night before, with eagerness and curiosity and hunger. And I found that the more ardently he touched me and kissed me, the more I shared his hunger. When he wore only his shirt and I only my shift, he guided us to the bed, under covers that his ravenous hands and body quickly made warm. That night, Alexander's heated whispers were in French as he made love to me. I didn't know enough of the language to decipher the words, but his meaning had never been plainer. All my life, I'd been the boyish sort of girl who preferred climbing trees and hiking through the woods, or the veritable spinster, more concerned with nursing 6 soldiers than landing one for a husband. I was the general's daughter who'd inherited the fervor of his warrior's heart. But Alexander's lovemaking found the woman in me, and the more claiming his touch, the more ecstatic my escape. He was as relentless in bed as he was in everything else, craving my surrender and winning it again and again.
"Oh, lovely wife," Crown me with everything that is tender and kind and passionate in you. Love me, he commanded. And I did. Oh, I did.
Chapter 10. On the first days of your wedding, I dare say you wanted nothing to do with anybody's letters, but I will now become bolder in interrupting your amorous occupations, as the importance of the matters I have to mention deserves some minutes' respite. You may therefore, my good friend, take this opportunity of catching breath with decency, which will be attributed to the strength of your friendship for me.
Marquis de Lafayette to Alexander Hamilton. An extremely waggish letter interrupted our honeymoon, reminding me that I was now a soldier's wife, an ambitious soldier's wife. The Marquis had returned from France a few months earlier, with the aid our cause so desperately needed. Supplies, money, a fleet of ships under the command of French General Rochambeau. It could change everything. It could turn the war. If we found the right opportunity. And my new husband was looking not only for an opportunity of victory, but also a chance to rise in station. The same man who pretended he could have been content to plant turnips enlisted Lafayette's help in a campaign to secure a promotion to adjutant general. And when that failed, Lafayette undertook to get my husband appointed as an envoy to France on a mission to obtain loans and expedite supply shipments.
Paris! I gasped from my seat before the fire in the sitting room. How would I fare in the social whirl of such a cosmopolitan place? But I'd scarcely had time to wish I'd better applied myself to learning the French language when we learned the appointment had gone to someone else.
"Worry not," Alexander said, bracing his hands upon the mantel and staring into the flames. "It appears I'll be shackled to a desk forever while my friends cover themselves in glory. Shall I never receive an opportunity for advancement?"
I went to him, searching for the best way to soothe my husband, as a wife should. "You're Washington's most trusted aide," I said, hoping the reminder of the vital role he played in the war would offer solace. "And as such, you daily command generals in the field even though they outrank you."
"Once, that might have been enough," he replied, unconvinced. "But then I met you."
He turned and took my hand.
"And now, instead of chasing a glorious death, I must somehow make a glorious life, which is a great deal more trouble, wife."
"Fortunately, husband," I replied, kissing his furrowed brow, "you needn't do it alone."
He sighed. "Alas, my duty is soon to separate us. You could make me forget the whole business of war entirely, but I suppose you are so much a Portia that if you saw me inclined to quit the service of your country, you would dissuade me."
"A Portia?" I asked, then instantly wished I hadn't. "No, please, not another Roman."
"But I pay you a compliment," he protested,
telling me at great length, with many quotations of the original Latin, plus a tangential dart into Shakespeare, of an ancient lady who, amongst other heroic things, patriotically concealed her sorrow to be separated from her husband when he went to war. But I didn't wish to be separated. I had no children to care for, plantation to manage, or homestead to defend. I had a husband, whose joys and travails I had pledged before God to share, and a war that I wished to have a part in winning. When I told Alexander that I intended to accompany him on his return to headquarters, he kissed my forehead and assented.
"I was hoping you might, my Portia. According to Plutarch, Portia's husband said of her, as I would say of you, 'Though the natural weakness of her body hinders her from doing what men can perform, she has a mind as valiant and as active for the good of her country as the best of us.'"
It was, I thought, the best compliment anyone had ever paid to me. "Why, Colonel Hamilton, I seem to learn something new whenever in your company."
Heat banked in his eyes. Perhaps if you submit yourself to my tutelage, you shall have a real education by spring.
An answering heat rushed over my skin, and I eyed him with curious hunger. Whatever would you teach me?
To start with, he began, drawing me back to our bedroom, your classical education is in vast need of improvement.
Whereupon he taught me, by way of demonstration, some choice Latin terms that would have scandalized a harlot, and I minded not at all. In truth, I counted myself the happiest of women altogether. Thus, after a perfect Christmas holiday with my family, I went with Hamilton from nuptial splendor and plenty to the scarcity of the army. General Washington's new headquarters was situated at a small Dutch farmhouse near the village of New Windsor, New York. Conditions for the ordinary soldier were dismal, the vast majority clad only in tattered uniforms, shirts, and breeches, shoes worn through, and not enough food or munitions by half. If they were lucky, they shared a single blanket between every two or three men. It was Jockey Hollow again, with milder weather. How had nothing else improved? It was unthinkable, but Congress claimed to have no legal power to tax and raise funds for the army they'd called into the field. Alexander argued that the power was implicit, that having declared independence and war, Congress should consider themselves vested with full power to preserve the country from harm. He was not the only one to think it. After the expiration of the 3-year enlistments that most had signed, the soldiers were angry at not being permitted to leave, at not being paid, at everything. Indeed, their discontent had boiled over into another mutiny only just resolved, and the tension around camp was still as thick as the frozen mud covering the ground. There was not a little fear that the troops might join Benedict Arnold, who had donned a red coat and recently captured Richmond, Virginia, for the British. It was within this surly atmosphere that Alexander secured for us a cramped and dreary room in a boarding house. But I could hardly complain when I saw what our countrymen endured. Instead, I donned practical and patriotic homespun and endeavored to make myself useful to Mrs. Washington at headquarters. There, alongside the great lady, I threw myself into writing letters to raise money, hosting dignitaries who visited camp, and helping the slaves prepare meals for Washington's little military family. Repetitive suppers of bread, butter, and a spicy tripe stew, the scent of which was not altogether appetizing, but better than what the ordinary soldiers ate by far. It was at one of these dinners that we were reunited with the Marquis de Lafayette. Having just negotiated the end of a mutiny in the Pennsylvania line, he returned to headquarters and broke the sour mood by hugging and even kissing everyone. I was startled that General Washington, a very formal man who did not like to be touched, allowed the Marquis this familiarity. Then Lafayette treated me to the same exuberant greeting, "Mademoiselle Schuyler, or shall I say, Madame Hamilton now?" he asked, kissing both my cheeks. "Marquis," I said, smiling. But before I could decide whether I was meant to return these kisses, Lafayette withdrew and wagged his finger at me. "I'm afraid I have a quarrel with you. I invite you to camp some years ago. You refuse me, yet for Hamilton, here you are. I would take offense if I did not so much approve of your choice."
"As do we all," said Colonel Tillman with a polite smile.
Seemingly caught off guard by the warm sentiment of his friends, Alexander flushed. Even as McHenry called,
"Speak for yourself, Tench. If you'd seen him strutting at his wedding, you'd know he doesn't need a thing more to swell his head."
Before I could flush at what might have been Mac's innuendo, and in front of the Washingtons, Lafayette unveiled a crate of champagne he'd acquired from somewhere and smuggled into the house.
"Since we could not all see the wedding, we celebrate tonight, we?"
Quietly, from his end of the table, General Washington said,
"A capital idea."
And that was all the approval the younger men needed to pop the cork and start pouring.
May I propose a toast?
Colonel Tillman asked from where he was seated beside Mrs. Washington. Tench didn't wait for an answer, but rose to his full height and raised his glass.
To our little lion,
he said to Alexander, respectfully and with genuine fondness. Then, turning to me, he added,
and to the finest-tempered girl in the world, a perfect match. May it endure and prosper with our country, with my blessing and unalterable friendship.
His graciousness moved me, and I hoped Tench might one day find a woman to love him as he deserved. I tipped my glass to him in return, hoping he could feel my good wishes before we drank. And then it was all laughter and merriment.
Congratulations, my boy,
Washington said to Hamilton with a fatherly tone, and my husband seemed not quite certain how to take it. Perhaps to ease the moment, Tillman continued,
We all knew your husband was a gone man for you, Mrs. Hamilton, the night he forgot the watchword.
At the reminder, Mac roared with laughter, recounting details Alexander never told me.
He's lucky he managed to wheedle it out of that boy who lived at headquarters, or the guards would have let him sleep in the snow.
Grinning, Hamilton protested.
I was determined to keep what little dignity I had left. I had to pretend I'd just be testing the guardsmen.
Even Mrs. Washington chuckled at this, shaking her head. And the toasts continued long after the Washingtons went to bed.
13 toasts, Hamilton insisted. One for each state.
Mac raised his glass, his Irish brogue more pronounced with every raised glass.
Here's to the four hinges of friendship. Swearing, lying, stealing, and drinking. When you swear, swear by your country. When you lie, lie for a pretty woman. When you steal, steal away from bad company. And when you drink, drink with me.
Huzzah! We all cried until all 13 toasts were made. I still remember the international brotherhood of that night so vividly. The French Marquis de Lafayette, the Marylanders James McHenry, Tench Tillman, and Robert Henson Harrison, the Connecticut Yankee David Humphreys, and Alexander Hamilton of the West Indies. My husband told me they were the only real family he'd ever known, and now I saw that they were a family. What's more, I felt privileged to be included. At our wedding, I'd sworn that my people would be Hamilton's. But now I set another silent vow that his people would also be mine.
My dear, I must pay you a compliment, Mrs. Washington said.
We sat together, huddled by the fire as cold whistled through the cracks in the weathered walls, great piles of mending at our feet in baskets. I'd been wondering how we'd ever make a dent as my fingertips stung from working the needle through the coarse cloth, when her words drew me from my thoughts. Oh, whatever for? I thought she'd praise my stitchery, but instead she said,
You've made our Colonel Hamilton very happy. I wasn't sure anyone could.
Pride stilled my hands, for she'd known my husband for far longer than I had. You do me a kindness. Just then, shouts erupted from outside and footsteps pounded down the staircase. General Washington ran past us, out the doorway, and his flight set my heart into a thunderous beat. His Excellency was so measured in all things that his alarm sent us following him out the front door into the biting afternoon. I braced myself for any possibility. Mutinous soldiers, perhaps even a British attack, and with all the general's aides, including Alexander, dispatched on errands. But I never expected to see the adjoining shed afire, hungry flames consuming the wall closest to where the enslaved laundresses worked over a campfire. Nor did I expect to see General Washington single-handedly heaving 3 enormously heavy washtubs of water upon the blaze before it spread to the house. Not knowing what else to do as the bodyguards came running, I rushed to get more water. But Washington already had everything smothered. Only smoke and black scorch marks remained.
Then the general leaned back against the house to catch his breath.
Good heavens,
Mrs. Washington uttered, her hand on her heart.